and welcome to England on 99.94, Cricket Every Day. I'm Rory Dollard, and with me today is someone who is not Daniel Norcross. You may be able to tell. It's our bro from another show. It's Neil Manthorpe. He's one of your Cricket South Africa 99.94 hosts, but he's here with me in New Zealand, where we've had another fun week watching England redefine the boundaries and reinvent Test cricket on the fly, really. So we're gonna talk about that. We're gonna look at some of the issues, some of the key performances, and see what it all means and where we go next. England on 99.94 is your new home for England content, and we'll be dropping into your podcast feeds, your YouTubes, your 99.94 app several times every week. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Or frankly, one of the three would also be fine. Thanks for joining Cricket's conversation. Manners, another week of Test cricket under Ben Stokes and Brendan McCullum. Another win and another big stack of entertainment. As someone who doesn't usually appear on this show, how are you finding it?
I'm loving it, Rory. I'm absolutely loving it. There's an old saying in commentary that you can't over-prepare. And I just in case, you know, going into a Test match, you're prepared for those quiet sessions, sometimes those quiet days. So all my notes about the Bay of Plenty, about Mount Maunganui, all of those notes that I prepared, it was Captain Cook who named it the Bay of Plenty. He sailed in the great ship Endeavour in 1769. I didn't mention any of it because there was no time. It was just non-stop action. And to see Test cricket played like this is something that I'd never imagined. Me and millions of other people who watch Test cricket it's different. I mean, I was glued to the television. That Pakistan series was a disaster for me. I missed meeting after meeting. I was pushing deadlines back because I couldn't take my eyes off the action. But it's different being there, watching all of the different moving parts that you don't see on television. It's just so much to discuss. And there was so much to describe on commentary. It was fantastic, invigorating.
I'm really glad you mentioned Captain Cook there, because England used to have a Test captain called Cook, and he did things a little bit differently to the chap we have in charge at the moment. And our first section, I would like to just get a little bit into the Ben Stokes captaincy machine, really, because you'll have seen the stats, no doubt, if you're listening to us here, that Ben Stokes has now overseen 10 wins from 11 Tests since he became permanent captain, 10 in 12 overall, because he did the job once as Joe Root's stand-in. And that makes him, give or take, the best starter as a Test captain in Test history, level with Lindsay Hassett, Australian captain from the 40s, 50s, something like that. And you know, I think in England, such reverential memories of Michael Vaughan's captaincy and how he picked the team up and lifted them. And he got his first 10 wins, took him 16 matches. So Stokes is entering unheard of territory. And I think what I would like to look at particularly is, we know how he's gone about it these last few months, but England have had a bit of a blind spot about pink ball day-night Test cricket. Ever since they're winning their first one at Edgbaston in home conditions, they have been absolutely hammered in every pink ball Test they've played since. They've picked the wrong teams, they've picked the wrong tactics, and they've been obliterated in Ahmedabad, in Adelaide, in Hobart, in Auckland. And it was kind of the last bastion of could Bazball overcome this little blind spot in English cricket. They didn't overcome it. They leaped over it. And I think the whole thing was set in motion by Ben Stokes' declaration on day one in the 59th over of the Test. And that set in motion a series of events that saw New Zealand, who won the toss in this match, batting twice at the worst conditions of the match to bat. And that's where the game was won and lost. And it was the bold, ambitious, optimistic way of going about it by declaring when he did that I think settled this match. And the rest of it was just putting the pieces in place.
I'm not a big fan of day-night Test matches. I love the idea and the whole innovation and the creativity and the thinking out the box. I love the idea of people coming to watch Test match after work and coming in, for the final couple of sessions, watching Test cricket under lights. I love the whole idea, but practically, it doesn't work, particularly not in a holiday town like this when there are, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 English supporters. Would you rather have them spending money in restaurants, having dinner after a day's play and buying beers and wine? Or would you rather, you know, try and take their tourist pound over a good breakfast? So it didn't make sense. And from a playing point of view, everything is geared towards that final session. You know, Ben Stokes was absolutely clear, crystal clear. He's very, very good at thinking on his feet. But one thing that was clear from the off was that England wanted a bowl at 8 o'clock, which is pretty much when the lights began to take full effect. And far too much weight is placed on that final session, isn't it? Under lights. And I mean, the declaration was the second quickest in the first innings of a Test match, the second earliest in the history of Test cricket. The other, the earliest one, an earlier one, which was something like the 35th over the innings, when Pakistan were 130 for 9 and then number 11 was injured. So, it was a forced declaration. But he said, did he not? He told the media after the Test match or after the first or second day's play that he would have declared 6 down. They happened to have 325 runs on the board, but the whole idea that he was just going to declare, I mean, he said, he'd rather have Stuart Broad and Jimmy Anderson bowling under lights than batting under lights, and that makes a lot of sense. There were 9 down. So, yeah, I mean, there is just a little bit too much weight, isn't there, on placed on that last session. But the way that England manipulated the Test match was extraordinary. The first session on day 3, that Harry Brooks 50-51 off 40 balls, and the exhilarating batting from Ollie Pope and Joe Root, 158 runs in the session, was fantastic. But there was a means to an end, and that was to be bowling at the end of the day. It wasn't just, they weren't just scoring at 8 and over because they can. They were doing it for a reason, strategically and tactically. It was just amazing to watch. And Stokes got it right because they were bowling in the last session of the day in both New Zealand innings.
Yeah, they won the game twice in 2 sessions under lights. And it was Ben Stokes' clarity of thought as a captain that got them in the position at the right time, and he lost the toss. You know, Tim Southee had control of the narrative, but you don't have to face Ben Stokes very long before he takes it off you. He that's what he does. He takes the narrative whenever he's involved in a cricket match, it feels like, and he bends the thing to his will, and that's where this Test match was won and lost. And I really do think, listen, England don't like Bazball. We know that as a phrase, and Brendan McCullum would rather pass the credit down the line. But this is Ben Stokes, isn't it? This is, the team is in Ben Stokes' image, and Brendan McCullum's key guiding principle is to give him the freedom and the belief that his instincts are right. And I honestly think people say that there's a defining year coming up, Ashes, India around the corner in the winter, two huge series, the big two series really. But things have been defined already. This team is defined. This captaincy is defined. Results will change, but the identity won't. The identity is locked in.
I wonder, Rory, whether people are right when they say that the Stokes-McCullum era has changed Test cricket forever. I think that they'll be talking about the Stokes captaincy forever. I think they'll be talking about this era. It's only 7 or 8 months old, but I think they'll be talking about it in 50 years' time. They'll, if you look at the number of moments in Test matches since Stokes took over the captaincy, there have been some extraordinary things. We forget them. I mean, New Zealand scored 550 or 560 in a Test match, a few months back, and England won that. They're redefining the way the game is played, and as I said, they'll always talk about it. But have they changed it forever? Because I wonder whether any team ever, let alone England, will ever have a captain and a coach so closely attuned and committed to doing the revolutionary, to play without even a consideration of defeat, never mind the fear of failure or the fear of defeat, which has defined most captains for, over a century. I remember when Kepler Wessels took over the captaincy of South Africa after their 20-year isolation, he said the first most important duty of any captain is to ensure the game cannot be lost. Only then must they consider victory. That's the other extreme, of course. But, you know, I just wonder when the next captain and coach come along, whether they will be as committed to continuing this style of cricket or whether they'll try and knock a few rough edges off Bazball.
Well, listen, it depends how the story ends, the story of the McCullum and Stokes era. If they walk into the sunset as champions, champion cricketer, champion coach, you just pick up and you carry on. If it ends in defeat, maybe people look again. But the one thing I would say for sure, I think it has definitely had a lasting and probably immovable impact on the future of Test cricket, is that now they've shown that the boundaries are a little bit wider in this format than people thought they were, that the parameters stretch a bit further than people thought they did. You can't be it unless you can see it. And people have seen it now. People can see that you can pull out and declare because you just want to bowl. You can change your field every ball. You can look to score at 6.5 and over because you think that the game needs to be advanced. There's a few lessons that teams around the world will have seen of late, and they just the imaginations have been freed up a little bit. They might not choose to take it every time, but the where this sport, where this format can stretch into, the borders have moved for sure. Listen, we're going to take a break. And afterwards, we're going to talk about the two old goats, I think. James Anderson and Stuart Broad back together and still taking wickets. And we'll look how long that might continue. We'll be with you shortly.
I'm Jared Kimber, and I host two podcasts on 99.94. Red Inca, which is chats on trends and stories within the game, with a weekly Q&A where I can be asked about anything from a time-travelling Don Bradman to which cricket ground serves the best food. And Double Century, a look at the historical stories that make cricket what it is today. You can search for either of them in your favourite podcast platform or on the 99.94 DM app.
So, Neil, James Anderson, Stuart Broad, they finally, you know, brought up their fate, their destiny, overtaking Glenn McGrath and Shane Warne as the most prolific, deadly bowling partnership in history. I think they're now on 1,009 test wickets between them. And it does feel inevitable. Certainly, for the number of times I've watched these guys do their thing, it did feel like that was their fate. But it's not so long ago since they were playing alternate tests in the Ashes. It's not so long ago since they were dropped for the West Indies and England had a red ball reset that did not involve them. Their hunger and their persistence in just doing this job, this hard, hard job, where they could be living and dining off their careers right now and having it much easier than they do, is remarkable. Just as a South African fan and a follower of Test cricket, these two guys, they kind of deserve to be on that top of the tree, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And the key to it is fun because, I mean, I think Jimmy is slightly different character to Stuart Broad. But if it wasn't fun, I think Stuart Broad would have walked away. In fact, I think when this red ball reset was put in place and he felt that he was being sidelined, I think he told people, didn't he, privately, that he was perfectly happy to walk away. He was happy with his career. He's got over 500 test wickets. He would have walked away. I think Jimmy's a bit more bloody-minded and, you know, he might have carried on a point of principle. But the fun element is what is keeping them going at the moment. They're talking about having more fun now than they've ever had before. And what's really interesting as well is that one of the cornerstone philosophies of Ben Stokes' captaincy appears to be a greater insistence on putting the team before any individual performance than I've ever seen before. You know, to the extent that Jimmy only bowled three overs. You know, they've manipulated the test match so that they're bowling under lights and Jimmy's only bowled three overs. Ollie Robinson bowled seven and Stuart Broad bowled 10 in a row. And so Stokes wasn't, you know, in any way pandering to Jimmy's reputation. And we'd say, no, it's Stuart's night and, you know, he's taken four. And then a similar thing happened on what turned out to be the final morning on the fourth afternoon, when captains just conventionally, they've got a bowler on four wickets, of course, and he's an opening bowler, of course you give him the ball to try and take his fifer. And Stokes didn't do that because the team came first. Jimmy was the fresh one. Stuart was a bit stiff. What I loved particularly, actually, is afterwards, after the Test match, when Ben was asked about them and he described them as the goats. Well, you know, by definition, a goat is a singular term, the greatest of all time. But they're both the greatest of all time. He said they are the goats. And he said, initially he said, I don't think their record will ever be broken. And then he thought for a moment and corrected himself and said, in fact, I'll go so far as to say it'll never be broken. And there are you know, records like Muralitharan's 800 Test wickets. You think that'll never be broken. I think this is even less likely to be broken. I think this is just set in stone. No bowling partnership in the future history of Test cricket will ever share 1,000 wickets on the field at the same time. There you go. It doesn't feel that big a statement, does it?
No. But the thing is, you'd have said exactly the same when Warne and McGrath went off into the long grass, because who the hell saw Jimmy Anderson bowling at taking his wickets at 20 by the age of 40? That was not in the cards. But you're right, nobody's going to be Jimmy Anderson again, and nobody's probably going to be Stuart Broad again. I mean, you say that a goat is a singular thing. They're Batman and Batman, aren't they? They're not Batman and Robin. There's no sidekick here. Like, watching Broad in that spell. And honestly, he's been performing well, and he's chucked in some big performances, but he hasn't gone on one of those tears, one of those Stuart Broad tears, I don't think since, as good as this, since 2016 in Johannesburg. This was his best spell for England in 7 years. And he shouldn't be doing it. He should be piping slippers and watching the next generation. But they're so fantastic. But Ben Stokes made a point at the start of this Test match when he talked to us, saying casting a forward, and they try not to cast forward too much, but we do persuade them to do it occasionally. And he said, come the summer, and bear in mind England have 6 tests in, you know, 7 weeks, probably 7.5 weeks with the Ireland Test and the Ashes. He said, the only thing I've told the powers that be above me, that's the medics, that's the management, that's the selectors. He said, give me 8 fast bowlers for the summer, because I'm probably going to need 8. So that you can be certain enough that these guys won't play 5 tests is too much. It's and that goes for the Australians as well, by the way. It's the schedule is not going to allow them to perform at this level. So I think we will see Stuart Broad playing at his best for England in the Ashes. He not at his most frequent. Don't think he'll play 5 tests. He might not play 4 tests, similar to Jimmy, because England have. And if you wanted to work out the 8, we could try and do it now. Anderson, Broad, Archer, Wood, Robinson. Then where do you go?
Stone.
Woke, Stone. Yeah, Potts. So England have the 8. If they keep them fit, England have the 8. The tough thing, and it hasn't really happened yet, is they're going to have to pick and choose their moments. And that's where the previous regime came a little bit unstuck. They got a little bit funky. They didn't always pick their best team. I think England have a bit more clarity at the moment. And I think they'll pick their best 11 until that 11 looks tired. And then they sub in.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, a few years ago, both Jimmy and Stuart seemed pretty irritated by this idea of rotation. And they were especially irritated at this philosophy that I'm not sure who it came from, that they couldn't play together anymore, that they couldn't play, you know, that they somehow constituted a liability if they were playing in the same test team. They were right to be irritated. And I think they were also not particularly sold on the idea of rotating in a test series. You know, I remember Stuart before the last Ashes said, well, why can't we play every test match? But now it seems not only have they bought into it, but they appear to be advocating the idea of playing one and resting one and playing one, resting one. The concern is that England pre-plan, that I'm sure Stokes won't fall into this category and McCollum certainly won't. I mean, you know, but the idea that they sit down before the Ashes and they go, okay, we'll play these two at this venue and he might suit him. And because if they go really well and they win the first test match in 3.5 days and they've got 3 days to rest, go with that. So you're right. I mean, you know, play the best 11 and keep playing them until they look tired or until one of them breaks, and bring a new toy in. They have to be, I guess it depends how it goes. But then at the same time, you know, if Jimmy bowls magnificently in the first test or the second test or whatever, and do you look ahead and say, well, he might be feeling fresh, but let's give him an extra week's rest anyway. I just love the idea that there are eight fast bowlers, and I don't think Australia have got eight, you know. I think they may be on sort of four or five.
Yeah. Well, listen, in the last Ashes series, Australia did rotate their fast bowlers, and they looked like they had the big deck of cards. They had Cummins, Hazelwood, Stark. They had Siddle on the bench. They had Pattinson on the bench, Neeser. They looked like they had options all over the place, and we were scrambling. It does look like it switched a little bit, and I think that's going to be the really interesting part to watch how Stokes shuffles that, because there are some decisions to make, and it's got to be smart. It's got to be right. Everything we've seen so far, these guys make the right decision an awful lot since they've taken over. So I'd kind of back them. Listen, now it's time for the final break. We'll be coming back very shortly to discuss the batting, and I think another selection headache potentially, and where we're going to go with that, because there's a queue of people putting their hands up, and we'll see how that's going to shake down. Back in a moment.
Whether it's missing flights or retirements out of the blue, whether it's resignations or bans, as the old saying goes, there's never a quiet day in West Indies cricket. So make sure you listen to West Indies on 99.94 to stay up to date with all the latest fallout with the teams in maroon.
Welcome back. Well, England didn't have any sort of super standouts, in the sense that the top scorer of the match went to Tom Blundell. He got 138 super innings, by the way, from Tom Blundell. England had a very pleasing, I think, for sort of the management team and the leadership group will be thrilled that everyone near enough chipped in. There's 50s, plenty of them. Innings, sparky innings. Ollie Pope didn't get a 50, but he got two 40s and really, really set the tone a couple of times. In his new sort of vice captaincy role, almost, I suppose. But the question that is hovering away in the background and is unlikely to go away is Johnny Bairstow is coming back. He's in the nets. He's in his cryo suit running on a treadmill in Headingley. And he comes back in because he was the player of the year last year. And something has to give. And there's two areas, neither of which they want to compromise on. One is Ben Foulkes. So you could sub Johnny Bairstow in, give him the gloves and say, hard luck, Ben Foulkes. They're not minded to do that. They continually ramp up Ben Foulkes. He played very, very well. He's an interesting counterpoint in the batting order. He does something a little bit different to what the top six are doing. And the other option is the opening pair. And Zach Crawley is the one who's still got questions to answer. There is a decision to be made there. And I really don't know how they're going to play it. And there are various options, but what it seems to me has clarified over the last 2-3 months is that sitting out Harry Brook is off the table. That's the pretty much. We know Bairstow's coming in, and we know Brook is not stepping out. So something has to give. Is that about right?
You're right about Harry Brook, for sure. I spoke to Michael Atherton about this yesterday, asked him where Johnny Bairstow fits in. And he said, it's funny how these things have a way of resolving themselves. You know, somebody will trip over an airport trolley and sprain an ankle at just the right time, and a space will become available. I also have been discussing it with my partner on the Cricket Collective podcast, with Talk Sport, Steve Harmison. And he's adamant. He says, if Johnny comes straight back in, he has to open. You have to say, sorry, Zach, but, you know, Johnny's the man and he has to open. I said to Harmy, would you be prepared to tell Johnny that he was opening? And he said, no. No. He said, that's a selector's job. Well, or you can ask Ben.
I was going to say, you'd want to be about as big as Harmy, I think, to tell Johnny that. Because, Listen, the thing with Johnny Bairstow is he has been plugged into so many different spots over the years. Keeper, not keeper. Going back number three in Sri Lanka, going back five, six. He's been up and down the order. He finally finds the spot where he flies to the moon last summer. And they're going to come back in and ask him to face Stark and Stark and Cummins with a new ball and Hazelwood. Jeez, I don't know about that. It's an answer. Whether it's the answer, I don't know. I don't think it's a given that they won't ask Harry Brook to open.
Okay.
That's not impossible.
And the other thing about Ben Foulkes is that he's been left out two or three times, hasn't he? I mean, he had COVID. He was left out in Pakistan in order to, you know, he's been the fall guy. My question to you, Rory, is if a group of lads, if six lads go out for a few beers out of town, they need a designated driver, right? Well, isn't Ben Foulkes the designated driver in this team? I mean, he looked after everybody. I mean, the top six, it looked like a benefit match, didn't it? It was 50 and out. Ollie Pope made 49. Everyone else made 50. 50 and out, off you go. And that's the way it looked. And suddenly England found, actually, they needed, well, they probably had enough runs. Well, they did have enough runs, but they needed to bat for another couple of hours. So sensible Ben came to the crease and did the job and drove the lads' car safely back home and dropped everyone off. Does the top order need a designated driver? Because he's the only one who can do it, to my mind, or is happy to do it, is a natural driver.
Yeah, I mean, that's the role that he does appear to play. And he, there was a sense of calm, wasn't there, in a match where England, and we haven't laboured it too much, but we were talking earlier about the way England pulverised Neil Wagner and hit him for 10 and over. Like it was somewhere between a T20 match and an ODI. He was every ball was lined up and they were stepping inside the line, looking over their shoulder, flogging it into the grass banks and not really worrying if they only had to do that two or three times because it's fine, the next guy will come and do the same. Now, I suppose with Ben Foulkes, the answer is that guy could be Joe Root. Arguably should be Joe Root. Has been Joe Root before. Now, he is in a place where he's testing. He's like the velociraptors in Jurassic Park. He's pushing at the electric fence and seeing if there's a gap. So at the moment, he's nudging at the fence of Bazball and seeing where he can, how far he can push it. But in the heat of an Ashes test match, in the heat of an Ashes series, will Joe Root drive the car? That's the, you know, that's the possibility. And then it might come to the fact where they say, actually, Johnny can keep. Ben Foulkes, sorry about this. You have to sit out. But there's not an easy decision. What I would say to England is that they've got good options. They're not, it doesn't feel that long ago that they were choosing between two bad options of how to balance up their team. And I think if you get to a point where you're now choosing between two good options, that's a healthier place to be. And that feels like where this team is. Listen, just on Harry Brook, we should go again. And we're going to go on Harry Brook a lot because that's what he's forcing us to do. He was named player of the match, actually. Arguably, it should have been Broad because he maybe produced that decisive spell. But Brook has landed in this team with this certainty of purpose and the utter belief. It couldn't have been a better timing for a young kid who likes to give the ball a tap to have Brendan McCullum and Ben Stokes being the one patting him on the back and saying, you go for it, kid. Because, listen, I was chatting to Joe Root and he was too polite to say it, really, because that's the guy he is. But I said to him, how many batters did you blood in your time as captain? And nobody really stuck the course, did they? We had players coming in, 5, 6, 7 tests, 10 tests. Who came in and nailed a top six spot in the 5 years Joe Root was captain? I don't know. Don't know if anyone did. He certainly would have killed to have Harry Brook in his team because this guy looks like we'll be talking about him for 15 years and he could be heading into Joe Root territory. I mean, it's crazy to say that after 5 tests, but listen, get on the watch right now because he could be the quickest batsman in test history to 1,000 runs. He could leave the top of that chart in dust at the moment. He's just looks so collected.
And if he'd made his debut in a different era, if he'd been brought into the Test team in a different era, things could have been very, very different. People telling Harry Brook, as they have told batsmen for over a century, this is Test cricket now, son. You can cut all that flashy nonsense out. You guard your wicket with your life. You don't give it away. You give the opposition nothing. Mm. And you play within yourself. And there must be generations of England batsmen watching Harry Brook now. You'd be able to name a few. I don't know. James Vince or whoever, just saying like, oh, if only I'd been given the license. If only I'd been told that it was fine.
Do you know who I'm thinking of? Joss Butler.
Right. Yeah, good point.
Joss Butler came into the Test team and said, and listen, this could be a media problem because we ask these questions for people who've had a great white ball career and then come into the Test team. I remember Joss Butler saying, I'll show you I can play Test cricket. I'll show you I can do that. And that meant putting all his shots away and trying to prove that he could wear, it's like when your scruffy cousin has to go to the family wedding and they put on the nice suit, but they don't look like they've ever worn a suit before. It doesn't fit. I wonder if someone like Joss Butler, he's got the England captaincy now in the white ball, so he's not exactly unfulfilled. But he must look at Harry Brook and think, geez, maybe I could have showed I could play Test cricket, but my version of it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I keep going on about how long Test cricket has been around, and it's been defined by removing all your bells and whistles. If you want to play Test cricket, then bells and whistles are not what is required. And it is. McCullum and Stokes are sort of going down the opposite line, aren't they? It's like, okay, no bells and whistles. You're not good enough for our team. It's Harry Brook is an interesting one because he hasn't really been written up, is it? Because he hasn't really received the acclaim, I suppose, or the spotlight in the media that a guy like Ollie Pope did. Maybe it is because he's a Yorkshireman. I don't know.
It's the Surrey tax, Neil. I told you this. It's the Surrey tax. You get another 10 or 20% if you come through at the Oval.
Michael Atherton said that not since Joe Root played his first few Test matches for England had he seen a player who looked so destined to play 100 Test matches until Ollie Pope came along. And now it's, 2-3 years, maybe even 4 years later. And I said again to others on air, do you remember when you said about Ollie Pope after he'd played 6 Test matches, you said he's going to play 100 Test matches for England? I said, and how would you compare Harry Brook now? And he's master of the understatement. He gave me two words, and those two words were better, probably.
Not a bad place to end. I should also add that Ben Stokes this week overtook McCullum's world test record for sixes in Test cricket. He's on 109 now. And I said to him in the press conference to Ben Stokes, do you think the guy who's going to replace you is already sat next to you in the dressing room? And he went, oh yeah, it'll take Brookie about 20 games to get past me now. So there we go. Thank you for listening to England on 99.94, where we speak cricket every day. Please rate, review and subscribe wherever you enjoy podcasts. And you can download the 99.94 app and follow us at England at 99.94 DM. I'm at the RVD. Norcross, who'll be with you with some World Cup info from South Africa, Women's T20 World Cup very soon. He's over at Norcross, neither angry nor cross. He'll be delighted if I tell him that. And Neil, you're available with Lungani with South Africa, but also on your personal.
Yeah, at Neil Manthorpe, that simple. And Lungani Zama is at WamZam17.
Never miss out. Join our 24/7 conversation on social media and follow us at 9994DM. Cricket every day, your way.
Hey there, and welcome to the Joy of Paddle podcast, hosted by me, Minter Dial, a veteran of the paddle tennis world, and sponsored by Paddle 1969. Whether you're a paddle tennis aficionado, just beginning, or have never even heard of paddle, or padel, as it's called in North America, this is an exhilarating new show that delves into the captivating stories of notable paddle personalities worldwide. In its inaugural season, you'll be treated to exclusive anecdotes, valuable tips, life lessons, and humorous moments shared by esteemed professional paddle players, industry insiders, and passionate paddle enthusiasts. With each season aligning with the Pro Tour, you can anticipate 2 engaging episodes per month. The Joy of Paddle podcast is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, where you can find other great shows in a number of categories, such as sports, health and wellness, true crime, and fiction. To find out more about Evergreen Podcasts, go to www.evergreenpodcast.com. Vamos!